Session number 12713, Mr. Tony Temple, reel 4.
Mr. Tony Temple, reel 4. Are there any other outstanding memories of Blackdown you have, Mr. Temple?
Yes, the entertainment and so far as live entertainment turned, within the regiment, was very slight. No concerts, no such things as ENSA. So consequently, we used to devise our own concert parties, where the band was the mainstay with the male voice choir and playing all the stuff that the concert party required. We used to form our own little party, as it were, and get the lads from the regiment, who some were damn good singers, and we would get these people involved as well, and we used to put on good concert parties. In fact, we used to be asked to go and entertain older people or people in homes, in hospitals, with this concert party. They were so genuinely good, and considering that they were all amateurs, and some of the lads who were singing couldn't read a note of music. They had to be coaxed through this with the tuition of the band sergeant and the corporals and bandmaster and that. And we used to put on some damn good concerts. And this involved, eventually involved, us getting into the drama field with some of the married women who were living in the quarters of the town with their husbands, formed this concert party, and a lot of us were all roped in for this sort of thing. And so we really had our own entertainment group within the regiment, which the day I was always noted for, even when we went abroad, wherever it was, even in the army, when we finalised, you know, we went to Malta, where there was nothing. We had our own concert parties. And I don't know whether this was partly because we were the regiment, we were the DLI, as it were, but wherever we went, we always used to get this formation of this concert party. And it was done by, as I say, every one of the regiment. We always managed to get some sort of entertainment going, regardless of where we were, providing we weren't actually in action, of course. You know, we couldn't obviously do it then. But wherever we halted for a while, always this seemed to come through, even when we were in the desert. And as I say, in Malta, when we had no band, because the band was, at the beginning of the war, that was it. You didn't perform anymore. You were then stretcher bearers or intelligence section. But we always managed to have this theme, always encouraged by the officers, you know, and we always had this reputation of being able to create our own entertainment at any given time, and it was, to me, it was a good thing.
When did you go abroad, Mr. Temple?
October the 15th, 1937, when we left Southampton for our destination of Shanghai.
Had there been much preparation prior to this?
Oh, yes. We were notified months ahead, because the effect of moving a complete battalion of infantry, or any other regiment for that matter, where they've got to take everything with them to go abroad, means a lot of arrangements have to be made for transporting the equipment and the men down to the ship, then the ship itself. And men have got to go on vacation leave, to notify their parents that they were going abroad. This wasn't a small thing. When you bear in mind that the normal term of service abroad at that particular time was 6 years. You went abroad and you stayed abroad for 6 years. So that it was a big thing in a man's life, especially a boy's life, who's 16 at the time, and he's going abroad for 6 years. He won't see his family for 6 years. And it didn't dawn on you at the time, oh, you were excited about this, going to Shanghai, this is great, you wanted to go there. But in retrospect and on reflection, when I think of a kid of 16 going to that and not thinking anything about it, you know, it amazes me, it really does, because we were all the same, all the boys were the same. They were so keen to get abroad. So there was a lot of preparation. When you're going overseas in the army, you've got to get all sorts of change completely. Whilst you still kept your khaki of what you used to normally wear in all weathers in England, you had to have khaki drill. What to go abroad with you, shorts, shirts, short putties, stocking horse tops, all sorts of thinner equipment that and clothing that you would need in the warm countries. But by virtue of the fact that we were going to go to Shanghai, which in the summer was red hot, but in the winter it got a bit colder, and it got even colder when we went to North China. So you had to be prepared for the extremes of temperatures, really. So you had your summer clothing as well. And when you think of, when I say warm clothing, when you went to North China, you had to have furs, because it was so cold that a sentry couldn't stay out on duty for his normally 2 hours. He was only allowed 1 hour out. And then he was dressed in a complete suit, fur coat, dressed from head to shoulders with a big collar and fur hat pulled down over his head. You actually couldn't see him now. If anything had happened and he tried to grab his rifle with his mitts on, he would have been in a hell of a state, because he wouldn't have been able to do a thing. But this is the sort of equipment that we were issued with at the time. Possibly nowadays, when you see the Marines going to Norway, they're comparatively lightly dressed. We were like polar bears, as it might call, hampered by all this gear. So the preparation of this sort of stuff was tremendous, as anybody can see, and it had to be all issued out, signed for by you, and packed away. You got another kit bag in order to do it, of course. And we didn't have kit boxes in those days. We just had you were just given what they called an overseas kit bag. So you had one kit bag for overseas equipment and one kit bag for your ordinary equipment. Overseas equipment wasn't all that much, because we didn't get the furs, natural fact, until we got to North China. But the other stuff, you had to have another kit bag in order to carry it. There was that much stuff to carry about. But it was a smaller one. But this went on board with you. But that was, and your kit bag went. That was cast as not wanted on voyage. You didn't see that again for a month till you got to your destination, and it was hauled out the hold. So what you actually carried was what you carried in your pack and your haversack. That was what you immediately needed on board, such as your light gear, your shaving kit in the case of the men. I mean, we had shaving gear, which we had to take, but we didn't use it. I mean, it was only bum fluff that we had, so we should send the cat round of a morning to lick it off. And the preparation would take us weeks in order to, get the shoulder. And in the meantime, of course, you had to have an embarkation leave, which was normally a month. So we were sent on leave for a month, but that was just prior to going. The rest of the preparation, the main part of the preparation was done before we went on leave. When we came back, then it was just a matter of tidying the loose ends up and getting on the transport and the train and down to Southampton Docks, and away we went.
As part of your preparation, were you given any lessons or lectures on China, where you were going, kind of life you would come across?
Well, not prior to going, Harry, but you remember the journey took us 4 weeks, and consequently, during that period of 4 weeks, that Major Hislop, who was band president at one time, he was then the commanding officer taking us abroad. He would organise lectures on various things, the customs of the people in China, how peculiar they were, what we would find when we get there, how to react in various, on any given circumstances. And one of the main lectures, of course, was the venereal disease, which was really rife out in China. It was, we found out when we got there. And whilst we were given these lectures by the medical staff, it was something which was a necessity. We talked about it in this country. I mean, there was always preventative measures that were talked about generally in this country, but overseas it was really rife, and the officers really had to ram it home to the lads when you get out there, mate. So we used to get these lectures on a fairly regular basis, plus the fact that you were going into an area where cholera was occasionally prevalent. You had to have had injections for that, and you always had injections before you ever went abroad whilst you were still in this country to prevent any sort of malaria disease or whatever. And when you were on the boat, you actually had the cholera injections. I think it was about a fortnight before we landed in China. And you were given those so that by the time you got there, were fully into your system.
You said you went on leave. Did you go home?
Yes, I went home for a month.
How did your mother react to the fact that you were going away for so long?
Well, not very happily, I'm afraid, because you remember when I left the school, Harry, she wasn't too keen on me joining the army, being such tender years, but we talked about it, and I said, well, there's nothing. When I joined the army, of course, we said there's nothing at home for me, because at that time of life, when the whole of the North East was in complete recession, there was nothing doing in shipyards or the mines. you couldn't get work, and unemployment was rife. And we talked about this and she said, all right, but when it came to go abroad, and I was going abroad for 6 years, and I didn't tell her that until we were halfway through my leave, and I let it drop gradually, you know. She was a bit dumbfounded when it really sunk through, you know. She said, 6 years is a long time. I said, well, there it is, Mum, I've got to go. And the excitement was building up in me the whole time, you know. But we left, I met the rest of the lads when we came back from leave in Newcastle Central Station. And we were chatting amongst ourselves while going abroad and jumping into the carriages. And I forgot to kiss my mother goodbye, didn't I, when I left the coast. And I got a grab of just before the train pulled out of the window to kiss her goodbye. And it was one of those things. You were so excited about going to places like China. And the destinations before we ever got there, like, you know, Gibraltar, Egypt, Port Said, Port Suez, Port Sudan, Aden, Bombay, down into Ceylon, and then up the China Sea to Hong Kong itself, and rode away around to Shanghai. And you stopped at all these places. And you got off the boat in these places, the various places. But you didn't get off as individuals like tourists do. We used to have to get off. And this is where the band came in again. We had our instruments. We would have marches. So we used to march everywhere. And they'd call this getting rid of your sea legs. But you had no free time to go ashore, as it were, and sightsee. You just went where the army decided that you were going to go. But the excitement of this trip abroad, the fact of the 6 years didn't really register until he'd been out some time. I said, bloody hell, 6 years is a long time. But then by then he couldn't do anything about it, and then you generally accepted the fact. But
so the journey itself, what are your memories of the journey?
The journeys were very good. We left the quayside, I think it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. With the usual, our band was on deck playing Auld Lang Syne, and there was another military band on deck. They were playing Auld Lang Syne, and everybody was cheering everybody, and whatever was happening, everybody was cheering everything. So it was, you know, like a ship leaving the quayside. And I was leaning over the side after we'd put our instruments away, watching the land slowly disappearing and looking at it for the last time, sort of thing. And a young chap, that was really Ginger Ford, and he was leaning over the side. And this particular moment that we were leaning over, the galley chucked some waste out of the kitchens into the sea. And Norman Gay said to Ginger, by God, where did you bring that up from? Well, Ginger Ford looked at it and he started being sick, and we hadn't even got out of the dock area. So consequently, Ginger was sick for the remainder of the journey till we got as far as through the Straits of Gibraltar. We didn't call it Jib at the time, but he was sick until we got there, and he couldn't eat a thing. Mention a bacon sandwich to Ginger, and he was to vomit straight away, no problem at all. And life on board, it varied. We again, as band, were again unit unto ourselves, and we went aboard with this new bandmaster Ribbon. Dougie Bolam, the band sergeant, he stayed with us. And it was again that thing that we were practicing and rehearsing, and anywhere that we could find, usually one of the mess decks where we'd rehearse our band. But we used to give concerts regularly for the troops. You not only travel with the LI, the whole battalion, and in fact, I say the whole battalion, that actually wasn't a full battalion because we had to leave some behind. But we were picking up some people in Port Sudan. As the 2nd Battalion were coming home, we were going out. There was a transfer of the 2 battalions going abroad. And we were going out, they were coming home. And they had left a number of men in Port Sudan for us to pick up, and they would continue their overseas service with us in China. So we had. I would think that we had about 400 men. Couldn't have been any more than that. We picked a couple of hundred up in Port Sudan, let's say, from the 2nd Battalion. So we had this routine with general, the rifle companies, well, they were doing the training just the same. Physical training, mainly theoretical, whatever the riflemen used to do at the time. We just carried on with that. We had a bunch of Navy blokes going out to join ships with us. Because this is how they used to transport people. There was no such thing as aircraft. And if a crew, a replacement crew, had to be ferried out to another port for the ships, then they were ferried out on troop ships. And strangely enough, the trooping season, as they used to call it, only operated from October to the following April. Now, from April to October, those didn't happen, of course. What would happen? Where would they get the ships from? I don't know. They'd have to halt the war and say, I'm sorry, but we don't operate until October. You'll have to stop the war, sort of thing. It was a peculiar shit if you think about it. But we enjoyed it. We were enjoying the trip. The weather was getting much warmer, of course. You were leaving the country in around about October. And the further south you went, it was great stuff. And we had to Gibraltar. We're about a day out of Gibraltar. And if you remember at that particular time, Harry, the Spanish Civil War was on. Well, of course, this brave told the ship to heave to. They wanted to inspect the ship, so Major Heslop says, right, oh, the man, go and get his rifle, load, give him some ammunition, and line the ship right the way around, which we did do. And they told the skipper, if they come aboard, well, it's up to you, you're the captain. He said, we'll just have to let them go and do what they intend to do to search the ship. This was arranged through them. We got back this afterwards, of course. But unknown to the Spanish gunboats, just over the horizon, because of the situation in Spain around the Mediterranean, the Navy had sent two very conveniently left out of sight until the radio men got onto them. And, of course, within the space of about 20 minutes before the Spanish could have, these two destroyers was looking down the gun barrels of two destroyers. So that passed off fairly evenly. They never bothered us again after that. We went round these straits into Gibraltar. We never called there. We went straight through to Port Said. But that incident, it was something out of the ordinary. You know, we thought, this is great sort of stuff. And so Major Heslop said, well, you know, put your rifles here. We don't need them. Half the damn things weren't loaded anyway. But that was we got our first insight of what a warlike action was going to be like if we were caught out at sea. Which we were, in actual fact, doing the this would probably come later on, which one of our companies was caught at sea on an Italian vessel. I'll tell you about that in a later stage. But we just carried on to Port Said, and we got off the ship at Port Said and had a march around Port Said for an hour or two and marched back onto the ship again, and the necessary business was done by the shipping companies, and away we went. And we went through the Suez Canal, which was a very, very strange. It really was, you know. We hadn't visualised going through the canal until we'd forgotten about it, until we actually come to it. And then, of course, and you went down in convoy, and we had to wait for the rest of the convoy. They were being manoeuvred so that you go down the canal, because it wasn't very wide. And if there was a vessel coming the other way, one of the two, I forget which way it was, I think it was those going towards Port Suez, which was south, because it runs north and south, had to pull into the side and moor to the side to allow the other vessel to come through. And this happened quite a number of times. But it was a weird sight to see sandbanks all around you and camels roaming around the place, you know, with the drivers, of course, with the riders. And on the road, maybe 50 yards away, you could see these cars and vehicles going along the road. There you were on this big ship, watching these things floating past. And we got the other side of that story when we came back to Egypt at the beginning of the war. We could see it from the land, and the ships were going through, and all they could see was the funnels. You know, it looked very peculiar. But we got over the experience, and we got into the Bitter Lakes. And mind that they've got a right name for that, Bitter Lakes. Because when we anchored there to allow various ships to come through from the other way, and we'd done a bit of swim, we allowed to go over the side and have a bit of swim with the boats were pulled out by the crew, you know, so that was anybody in difficulties. And that was where I got the first taste of Bitter Lake, and mind it was bitter. I've tasted some salt water in my time, but that really was terrible. We didn't stay very long in that. We just get back up the ship and climb up the side of the ship, you know, the rope ladders and that, all we went. But this happened, as I say, in Bitter Lakes. We would have bitter experiences later on in life on the Bitter Lakes. But then the convoy got weighed up again, the way we went through to Port Sudan. We went through to Port Suez first. And I can't remember, Harry, if we actually stopped at Port Suez. I don't think we do. I think we went straight through the Red Sea, calling it Port Sudan. And this is where we, in the meantime, of course, we changed on from our khaki into the khaki drill, which you have a photograph of Norman Gay and myself. And we called into Port Sudan, where we picked up the remnants of the 2nd Battalion, got them transferred aboard, and then away we went. And as a consequence of that lot joining the regiment, or joining the battalion, they had a different type of uniform. It was a different colour and it was much more refined. And it was really first-class stuff. Whereas we had the old army issue from Blighty, as we used to call it then, was different altogether. We said, we had rubbish compared to them. And we said, how did you get this stuff? Where did you get it from? And they kept saying, you'll find out when you get to your destination. You'll find out. And sure enough, we did. When we got to Shanghai, a month later, yeah, the commander said, we've got to have the same sort of stuff as this, but unfortunately, the army doesn't issue it, so everybody's got to buy it. And so we had picked up this contractor in Hong Kong, and when we got to Shanghai, of course, he was measuring everybody in the regiment. He was on a good thing. He was issuing this grand stuff that the 2nd Battalion had got, including horse tops and shorts, shirts, trousers and everything, you know. Sure, long sleeve shirts as well. It had to be in the same material. It was far superior material, but mine, it was reasonably cheap enough, but the money that we were getting, we could hardly afford it, but nevertheless, we had to do it. And that was one of the insights we got from them. But they integrated into the battalion fairly well. Most of them, well, I'd say nearly all of them, all Geordies, just the same as myself. We had a good... After that incident with the Spanish gunboat, we didn't have much of... any incident at all, other than the old punishments that you used to see, mainly by the Navy, that a queer sense of punishment at all. Oh, one thing I did omit was that when, just prior to us getting on the boat, about a week before we left the boat, Charlie, we came back from our vacation leave, Charlie Gower, the solo cornet, didn't turn up. And we went onto the boat, I think it was on the 15th, or we sailed on the 16th. Anyway, the commanding officer sent out, they knew where he was, and sent out a couple of blokes from the regimental police, picked him up in London, unfortunately got him back, otherwise he would have been charged with desertion. And the commanding officer dealt with it himself. And being a friend of the band, he was dealt with fairly, really lean. He had no intentions of coming back. Because he letting his hair grow to a slowly style that he had. It was upturned. He looked really marvellous when he come on board, and we had these old crew cuts, you know. But fortunately for him, Major Heslop was a friend of the battalion, the E-band. Otherwise, he really would have gotten into trouble with it. He would never have been charged as a deserter, but certainly absent without leave, which meant at least 10 days, 14 days CB, if not in the glasshouse. He would have gone back to Aldershot for that. But the Major Heslop decided to deal with it himself. He was punished, of course, but that was one of the things I omitted when we started off.
You mentioned experience of Navy punishments. What was that?
Well, I don't know what wrong these lads had done. There was two of them. We hadn't experienced anything like this, and we never did. One of their petty officers was to carry out the punishment. We had a contingent of about, I think, 20 or 30 going out to join a ship. I think it was in Bombay at the time. They had done something wrong. We never really found out what it was, but part and parcel of it was running around. They borrowed a couple of rifles off regimental police, off the guard room, which still had a guard room on board where the rifles and ammunition was kept. They were in charge of that with a detailed section of men. And they borrowed a couple of rifles for these blokes, and they had to run round and round this deck with the rifle held up above their heads, and they never stopped for an hour. In fact, they were ready. When they did stop, they must have lost half a storm of the sweat that was coming down because it was red hot. It was at the height of the afternoon. They were in a state of collapse. I mean, it would never have been allowed today, but in those days, sort of punishments that you used to get, especially the not the boys, but certainly the riflemen and the various companies. And this never, I've never seen anything like it in my life. I've never seen anything like it since. And we used to call that naval petty officer all sorts, but it didn't make a hell of a difference to him. He just shrugged it all off. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but he won't break him. And that was the sort of punishment that they were subjected to, which all blokes weren't. They were confined in a cell, maybe, and they were brought out for whatever punishment, confined in the cell, but they were brought out daily to do the normal training, and at night time they were bummed back in the cell again.
What was your accommodation on the ship like?
Well, the accommodation was split up into mess decks, much the same as Royal Navy. I think nearly all the troop ships, because they were specially designed troop ships, were all segregated into mess decks, where you would have about 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5, anything from 5 to 12 on one side, long tables suspended from the ceiling by these metal rods with legs underneath us to make them steady so that they were wedged fairly securely in case of bad weather, with rims around the outside so that anything that was sliding on would be stopped by these rims. It sometimes made it a bit difficult to eat, but you got used to it, and for the month that you were at sea, you got used to it. That was accommodation. You had accommodation that you issued with a hammock with a couple of blankets in, and this was really funny. It was really when they see someone trying to get in the hammocks. Well, one old sailor gave me the tip, and he said, sling it. You're allowed to sling it anywhere, in actual fact. There was no set place for you, but we used to try to get together and sling it across the mess deck. So we always had something to jump on if they get out in a hurry. And unfortunately, some of them weren't. And this old sailor said, look, the best way to get next to a beam and just use a beam, haul yourself up and drop yourself in. Well, if you'd seen the performance of someone trying to get in this without this knowledge, you know, they were jumping on, they were trying to turn on the crossover, they would eventually get in, and suddenly the hammock would twist and go flat out on the floor again. It was hilarious to watch them until they eventually showed them that they'd never got the hang of it yet, of hauling themselves in and lowering them into the open thing. Because mind, it didn't open, Harry, in actual fact, it was just a hammock. So what we crafty blokes done, we got a piece of wood from the chefs, from the cooks, and just wedged it across and tied it in at each end. So when we opened the hammock, we just wedged these two pieces of wood in it for head and foot. Well, it was already open, we had no problem. Just nicely, just for this. It's lovely sleeping in a hammock when the ship's at sea. There's a bit of a swell on, you know. It rocks you to sleep so gently, and it's absolutely marvellous. You can get off to sleep in a crack. No problem at all. But these guys were never mastered this. Well, it was hilarious. You just slide about and watch them. The other thing with the hammocks, that when they used to come down and wake you up in the morning, which the guard said, we mentioned the guard room. You always had a guard commander. It didn't matter where you were, you always had a guard and guard commander. They would sound revally over the tannoy, so the duty bugler. But he would come round with his stick and go in a wonderful position to wrap their asses underneath the hammock, you know, anybody who didn't get out. This was sometimes a rude awakening. But we suffered very well. We didn't suffer, so we fared very well. But there was the knowledge of this old sea dog that to give us a tip from all that. The canteen facilities were fairly good. It was all duty-free. But in those days, it was duty-free. Not like it is now with duty-free shops. This was run by the Nuffy. The shops on board were run by the Nuffy, and it was all was duty-free. So that you paid much, much less for your cigarettes or your pop or your chocolate, which we used to buy. I mean, you weren't allowed to buy beer. This was out of the question for young boys under 18. You weren't just allowed. One or two of them tried, one or two of the other lads tried, but they never got away. They all, this bloke behind the counter used to say, well, come back when you're 18, son, you know. But no, he used to get it. But the Nuffy shops were quite well organised. They weren't too large. I mean, it wasn't the sort of shop that you went into. It was sort of a space that had been shuttered off, built when, I suppose, the ship was built with a shutter, where you could see all the goods that were on sale to you. But you couldn't actually go in the shop itself, and you just paid your money, whatever it was, and you went on your way.
Was the food any better from barrack room life?
About the same. About the same, I think. I can't recall accurately whether or not it was any better. We're still eating, let's put it that way, because we're all as hungry as dogs, you know. Whatever they provided, we always ate. And you couldn't supplement it. Like we could ashore, where you could, when you were in the Nuffy ashore, you could go to the Nuffy at night or sometimes in about tea time, go and get yourself an egg sandwich or a small supper. That wasn't done on board ship. We missed that. Your last meal at night was about 8 o'clock when you had a cup of cocoa and a couple of hardtack biscuits, and they are hard. You believe me, they are hard. That was it until the next morning at breakfast, which was usually a porridge, bacon and egg, bacon and sausage and beans or whatever. The food was palatable. I wouldn't say it was gourmet, but certainly it was palatable. And
it was the heat, like, it must have been getting very hot, and you were below decks.
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons why a lot of the blokes, as I said, we weren't restricted on the ship to where we slept. And a lot of us, when we started getting on the area of Port Sidon and even getting further the Red Sea, because in the Red Sea and Port Sidon, it really is stinking hot. you're talking about 120 degrees in the shade, you know. Some of the lads, the regiment, the second battalion, in actual fact, served in Khartoum, and they used to tell us anything up to 130 in the shade. It was, I mean, they were black. They were literally black when they come on board. We thought they were wogs. Pardon the expression, but we really thought they were wogs, you know, and it was oppressive. So we used to find places on the deck, away from the engine room, or any enclosed space, where there was a little bit of breeze, we used to try to bed down there. And it was always a race to get up there, and who was going to get the best spot. But sleeping down below, we used to avoid it as much as possible, because it was so oppressive, the heat. Because you're in the realms of this heat, you know.